The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul, your host, with Drew Campbell, editor of Institutional Investing in Infrastructure. Drew, this is the first time in a long time you've been on the program. I'm looking forward to getting updated on both the virtual roundtables you've been having, which I know that's been a big part of it. You have your annual board meeting coming up. We've got the November and December issue that hopefully we will have some time to cover. Good to have you back, Drew.
Yep, good to be here, Mike.
You know, you've had a spate of these virtual roundtables, as our other magazines have done. We've obviously, because of COVID and not having live events for a while, you've been doing a lot of these virtual roundtables. I want to talk to you a little bit about what you're hearing there. And we'll also talk about the upcoming live event, finally a live event in December coming up for I3, as we call it, Institutional Investing in Infrastructure. Internally, anyway, we refer to it as I3. Yeah. So let's start with the virtual roundtables. What has been the conversation around infrastructure? What's been kind of maybe dominating the discussions?
Well, we started the virtual roundtable series in the first part of the year. And so the topics have sort of evolved as the market evolves. So it's been, as far as exactly what we're talking about, it varies depending on what part of the year we're in. So there's been...
Now, don't get dodgy on me. Don't get dodgy on me here.
Well, I'm going to go... Recently, there's been a lot of talk about inflation. So energy prices have been... creeping up and really spiking. And a lot of the discussion has been around the ramp up of renewables and the push to get renewables online. However, they're intermittent. So when the sun goes down, you know, there's no solar power. When the wind doesn't blow, there's no wind power.
So we need it all. We need that around the clock. Let me ask you about inflation, though. And then you can go ahead and fill out some of the other topics, perhaps. Inflation is so immediate, and it's happening now, and we don't know yet whether it's going to be, as they say, transitory or abiding. They use a different term than abiding. I use abiding because they don't like to use the same term as everybody else. I don't want to sound like a parrot, but I did say transitory, so I usually will say fleeting or abiding. At any rate, Drew, here's the thing. Inflation bodes well for infrastructure investing, does it not?
Infrastructure, certain infrastructure sectors and assets can provide an inflation hedge, and that depends on sort of the contracts that are written into these assets and investments with investors. For example, regulated utilities are required to sort of raise rates as inflation goes up. And pass that through to consumers. So if you're an investor, you get that step up.
Nice little bump.
Right? Yeah. So, however, we're in an environment now where the discussion is, and this has been discussed on the roundtables, where we're in a COVID environment. The economy is not great. People are economically not as well off as they were, say, 3-4 years ago. And so utilities work with regulators to, set the increase in rates. And there's been discussion of having caps on rates for certain segments of, the population, just because they're already sort of stretched thin by the COVID economy. And regulators are wary of passing on more costs to them. So what was once thought to be sort of a no-brainer decision that you invest in a regulated utility and you get your inflation hedge is sort of coming into question now.
Wow. So you mentioned, speaking of utilities, you also mentioned energy being part of the discussion. Is it entirely renewables, or is are fossil fuels also part of the discussion? Because obviously fossil fuel prices have really escalated to a lot of people's chagrin.
The second part of that energy discussion we were having was that renewables are ramping up, but they can't do what, say, oil and gas can, or hydrocarbons, in that, or coal, just supplying a baseload source of power that's always there. So as renewables ramp up, they're intermittent, and there's not the, we need the storage technology there to store renewable power. That then can be delivered more on a 24-hour basis, but that's just not there yet. And then there's been a push to decarbonize the economy, and so there's been pressure on natural gas sources and oil sources, and it's been some of the discussion on the roundtables is how it's difficult to finance those sources. It's getting really expensive because the pressure being put on those sources of fuel, just in the push to get to net zero goals and decarbonize, is really making them sort of, I don't want to say third rail investments, but they're, they come with some of that climate net zero baggage. So anyways, right. The net result is that you've got renewables that can't supply the power all the time. And then you've got sources of oil and gas that just aren't what they once were. And so it can create spikes in energy prices. So that's
right. So in an ideal world, the sun would shine, every day, we'd collect it by day, and the wind would blow every night. We collect the wind power by night, and we've got no intermittency. But that's not really the way it works, unfortunately. And there are other sources of power. Hydropower, I understand hydropower is diminishing because we've had this drought and there's less water to run through the generators. Then you've got geothermal, which never has seemed to take hold in any significant way. But let me ask you about nuclear. Is there any conversation around nuclear? Are people talking about that, or is that a bridge too far and just so expensive that it's not really being seen as investable? Also, all the legal obstacles around it. Anytime somebody proposes a nuclear plant, a fuselage of lawsuits follows, it seems.
Well, there's definitely still discussion about it. I was on a webinar, I think this was 6 to 8 weeks ago, that was in the UK, and there was a lot of discussion about nuclear power.
And these new reactors? You've heard about these new small modular reactors?
Yeah, that's a lot of the discussion was about. When we think of nuclear power, we think of these large, just big power plants, kind of like the big coal-fired, power plants. But there's been this push to get these modular reactors that are much smaller. They have a lighter footprint, and they can supply a lot of power. And they're, nuclear has sort of been run through the gauntlet. And so all the risks are known. And it's just a matter of sort of executing on these, constructing these smaller reactors. So there's still companies doing it. There's still interest in doing it. And people still insist that it's going to be part of the mix. So they're going to nuclear's, people insist it's not going away. It's going to be part of the net zero push. It has to be.
Well, yeah, that's part of the argument, is that you're just not going to get renewable sources in place fast enough to meet these goals, and nuclear can play. Right now, it's 20% of U.S. power, roughly. 20% of U.S. power is nuclear. But we haven't built a plant in, decades? This old technology, the new modular, the small modular reactors are the newer technology, safer. They are kind of built in a way, now this is the companies talking, but that they really can't melt down. They have a different technology that makes them, that doesn't mean there can't be an accident of some type, but But nonetheless, we're in a pickle right now. And in the short term, they just feel that it's a bridge technology until we can master nuclear fusion, which we've only been working on for, what, 50 years or more, and we still aren't there. So
yeah,
I don't know about that.
Maybe one day.
We'll see. Exactly.
Maybe that breakthrough will come through and everything will be solved.
Yeah, eventually. We certainly hope so. So you mentioned, of course, energy. You mentioned inflation. Are there some other topics that the virtual roundtables have been circling around?
One that came up recently was the passing of the infrastructure bill in Washington, D.C. And it was a lot of the reaction from the private investment managers and just investors in general. It's in the United States, at least, that might help around the margins, but it's not going to be, there's no structural changes in this policy that's going to make a huge difference for private capital to get invested in public infrastructure projects in the United States. It's still sort of a tedious process going through state and local governments. There's 50 states and then a plethora of local governments, and a lot of them have a lot of say in what goes on in their infrastructure.
As part of this legislation, there's nothing written into the legislation that's really driving private investment that's kind of clearing the way for PPP.
Well, there is. There's actually one thing that is new. It's called a value for money analysis on large projects. So it's projects that are $750 million or more, and the sponsors of those projects have to look at it a traditional procurement route, which involves municipal financing typically. And then the public-private partnership route, and they have to do an analysis of both, and look at the costs and benefits of each. They're not required to pick either one, but it is a step forward in that a lot of these infrastructure agencies that are responsible for procuring infrastructure are on large projects are going to have to do a value for money analysis that looks at a P3 option. So. That's some progress forward. It doesn't guarantee that a P3 is going to happen. And then I'd say another interesting part of the bill is there is a carbon capture element to the bill. And there's a lot of money that's been put into researching and setting up facilities to finance carbon capture projects. One of those is called the Carbon Dioxide Infrastructure Finance Innovation Act. And there's this is similar to an act in the transportation sector and the water sectors. And that helps bring together public money and private money on projects for carbon capture. So that looks to be an area that in the energy sector, that could be sort of midstream infrastructure. There could be sort of green shoots there.
Interesting. Now, these are virtual roundtables you've been doing, but you do have finally the live meeting coming up. The dates on those come up in December. What are those dates again, Drew, and where will it be held, and what will be the objective?
So this will be in Huntington Beach, California, December 7th through the 9th at the Hyatt Regency down there. And this will be our first in-person meeting. We had one in, I believe it was 2019 was the last time we had the in-person. We switched to virtual in 2020. Like all of our board meetings, the objective is to get investors, consultants, and managers together. Just discussing, the most important issues facing them with regards to fundraising, portfolio construction for investors, capital deployment, alignment of interests for investors and managers, and all that good stuff. So it'll be good to be face to face again, because I think that's where these meetings really can show their value.
Yeah. Yeah. So Huntington Beach, California, it is. And I know that we just did our annual editorial advisory board meeting for Real Assets Advisor, and you could just tell people are just, you know, busting at the seams to get out and see one another and be in person. There is an excitement and energy level that I think we haven't seen in a while. So I'm expecting that'll be a terrific meeting, Drew. Now, that's the, you know, live, the talking part of the operation, whether it's live or virtual. But then, of course, we're a publishing company, and you did publish the first week of November a special report on innovative financing. Talk a little bit about that. What kind of prompted that? What can readers expect from that?
So this is our second report of this series. And the sort of objective of this is to bring together the public sector and the private investors that work on public-private partnerships and other public-private innovative financings for infrastructure. Now, outside of the United States, public-private partnerships have been used much more, and there's much more of a track record, say, in Canada, Europe, United Kingdom, Australia. But in the United States, there are some states that are more ahead of the curve than others, say, Texas, Virginia, Florida, Colorado, or some of those, in using P3. But it hasn't taken hold like it has in some of these other countries. And so the purpose of the report is to sort of be a starting place for the public sector, public officials, and private investors, private managers with private capital to really begin sort of rolling up their sleeves and looking at the sort of roadblocks and the issues that are impeding more use of these P3s. So, you know, we invite participants to do Q&As and write features about that topic. So like I said, this is the second report we've done. The first one was published last year in November. So, you know, we're excited because we've gotten a lot of support for this report. There's a lot of interest in this report. There's a lot of interest in really, you know, solving or cracking the code of how do you get more private investment in U.S. public infrastructure. So
it seems so strange that here we are, a free market society. We try to privatize everything, it seems like. We even privatize prisons, for crying out loud, in some cases. But infrastructure is something where we run behind Canada and Europe and other countries, yeah, in terms of private investment. And it just seems strange that
There are some sectors. So there's the rail sector, the energy sector, maybe telecommunications that has more private investment in it. But generally speaking, that's true. There's not it's not the same sort of track record that these other countries have. So, and a lot of that has to do, we have a municipal bond market, which really is a source of low cost financing for government. And so it's a really easy decision for public officials to just take out municipal debt to fund their projects because it's low cost and it looks good on the balance or the balance sheets. So,
and they don't have the headache of people in their communities or states saying, no, we don't want you to sell off our infrastructure to private interests. Well, right. We're not really doing that.
That's a sticking point. Yeah.
But it's a ridiculous one in a lot of ways because not everything's investable by private sources anyway, and it's not that they're surrendering these facilities to private interests; they're contracting with them,
and
making certain promises to them in terms of returns and also certain requirements that you must accomplish this, that, and the other thing.
One of the shortcomings of the sort of traditional procurement model for, you know, public agencies is that, or one of the knocks they have is against it is that it doesn't capture 30 years of operations and maintenance for these assets. It's not budgeted for. And so you'll find, you know, in a lot of cases, infrastructure in the United States is in poor condition because it's just not contracted for over a 30, 40 year period. And so the money's not guaranteed to be put into the operations and maintenance of the asset. Whereas if you're using a P3, all that is contracted for. And so it may look like when you're using a municipal financing for infrastructure, like public officials often do, it looks like it's the, you know, most, the cheapest way to do it, but it also often doesn't take into the account the 30-year period, 40-year period of the asset, and how much money needs to go into the operations and maintenance of that asset. The P3 does do that.
Yeah.
So over the longer term, that's where that I mentioned that value for money analysis in the large projects and the infrastructure bill. Doing that type of analysis will show public officials, you know, the true costs over 30, 40 years.
There we have it. So before we wrap things up, Drew, let's say in the event that our listeners have taken a hiatus from IE3 and have not yet seen the November issue, why don't you give us a summary of some of the contents that you have in the November issue, as well as looking forward to the December edition, which we'll be publishing soon.
Yeah, so there was a couple interesting, well, the whole issue was interesting, of course. There's a couple that stood out, and one was a feature story, our lead feature story on cyber threats and infrastructure. And that just took a look at, you know, there's been a lot of recent high profile cyber attacks, like the Colonial Pipeline is one of the most recent in the United States. And then there's a Portuguese utility, EDP. And in Italy, there's an electricity gas utility, Enel. And in Brazil, Eletrobras. And all of these had these cyber attacks. And so this feature story takes a look at that.
Does it say that they can do a better job of protecting themselves? I mean, nothing is bulletproof, I suppose, but what needs to happen? I mean, are these attacks that have happened? In the case of Colonial Pipeline, my understanding is that they really didn't take the kind of measures that they should have been taking to protect the, their own digital infrastructure.
Yeah, there is a lot of room for improvement, we'll say. So, I think a lot of these companies are sort of getting caught flat-footed, but they're increasingly realizing that this is a threat and it's going to cost money. So there are consultants that they can work with, IT consultants, and cybersecurity experts that they're now more aware of, and integrating those technologies and processes in their operations. And it's, you know, as everything gets more digital, the chance of hacking goes up too. So, and that's, we're living in a digital world now and everything seems to be going digital. So that threat and that risk will only increase.
And there's literally digital warfare going on. I mean, if you look at Ukraine, now I don't think we have necessarily any investors in Ukraine, but Russia is constantly attacking through cyberspace, constantly trying to mess them up. And there's also, China's been accused of after an agreement with Obama that they were going to not do this anymore. Neither party was going to get engaged in that. They are now being accused of actually professionalizing their whole hacking, making it more organized and stealing industrial secrets and so on. It's a problem that we haven't even begun to surmount. And I don't even know if we're going to be able to, because, you know, as the technology gets better, people who would use it for nefarious means have more powerful technology to attack the more protective technology. So yeah,
it's going
to
be a constant game of cat and mouse, I'm sure. So one of the points that our writer Alex McMillan made in his story was that in 2020, the ransoms paid for cyber victims of cyber hacking, they ended up paying $400 million in ransom in 2020. And that's according to the U.S. Treasury, which is four times the amount paid the year before. So it does seem like this is just going to be
the stakes are rising,
an increasing risk. So,
yeah.
And of course, companies and investors are going to, you know, investors in particular, they're risk averse and they want to understand their risks and mitigate them. And so I imagine, you know, more interest and focus will be put into that area too.
Anything else in the November issue you'd highlight before we get to December?
Another story that we published was on GRESB's infrastructure fund assessment, its infrastructure assessment. So GRESB is an ESG data analytics company that measures assets, funds, companies, performance on ESG. And so each year they do an assessment, and companies and asset managers and funds participate in it. And they tell GRESB, you know, GRESB asks, you know, a series of questions to get at, you know, how good of a job are you doing with your ESG processes. So one of the highlights, I guess, was that this year there was a 26% increase by the number of fund managers completing the assessment. So, and then they also, let's see, the fund assessment grew by 41% to 106 participants. And GRESB puts that out every year. And so they were seeing an increase in interest this year in particular. So that was an interesting point.
So December, which is in the making, you've got that one baking in the oven right now. What are readers can they look forward to?
So December, we are writing about utilities, social infrastructure, the market for creating carbon offsets. So, you know, if your operations and your processes are producing carbon, ways to offset that. And then we had a feature on transportation infrastructure and how it's going through transitions. So that's, and then we had a...
Is the transportation infrastructure, are you talking roads and bridges, or are you including rail and air? And what's the scope of the transportation coverage?
It was largely roads, but and in particular EVs. So the transition to electric vehicles and the need for EV infrastructure. And that's an area of interest for infrastructure investors. A lot of people think that that's a place where there'll be good returns on capital. And there's a real need to get, before you can have electric vehicles on the road, you have to have the infrastructure that can support them. So that's still a need to invest in that infrastructure. So the article typically just focuses on roads and automobiles and other vehicle fleets using the roads and electric vehicles.
All right. Anything else from December, or are we going to keep that under wraps?
That's pretty much it. I think, the utilities and transition was another one. And that's utilities are, so for example, you're in California and you mentioned that, you know, the droughts are sort of taking a toll on hydroelectric power. There's just not enough water to drive the, the turbines. And, you know, that's an issue across the West. And utilities are also managing through, you know, wildfires and other climate-related, severe weather. And they've always had to deal with severe weather and those types of events, but they're happening more frequently and they're becoming stronger. And there's a need for more investment to mitigate it and then also sort of change their processes so they're not as vulnerable to those types of things. And typically the way they do that is raising rates. And we discussed earlier that regulators are in this COVID environment and the economy not being as strong as it once was, they're hesitant in some areas to raise rates on consumers who they think may not be able to afford it. And so it creates this problem for utilities who are used to raising rates to raise capital to then invest in their infrastructure whenever they need to.
Now you're in Colorado, you're in the Denver area. Is Colorado in drought mode, or are you still flush with rain and snow?
We're not drought mode, but it's been a dry winter so far. There hasn't been a lot of precipitation, but we're not drought, I don't think. We're probably, or I wouldn't say it's severe. It's not like California, let's put it that way.
Yeah, no. Or, you know, there are a lot of Western states, it's pretty bad and getting worse. So no doubt we're going to have to start thinking much more about recycling water. I know there's a program, we wrote about that in Real Assets Advisor, that there is a bill that's made its way through Congress to fund recycling plants in the West to take water from sinks and toilets and so on. And it actually creates very pure water, so pure that they actually have to add in minerals so that people get what they should be getting out of drinking water. Yeah, it's one of those issues we're dealing with, and we never hear about desalination plants, or very rarely, unfortunately. But there's some issues with that as well. Huge energy consumption, as well as now you got to dump the salt out in the ocean, and it can't be done in one spot, or you disrupt the ecosystem. It's one solution, and then some kind of remedial measures that need to be taken. You know how that goes, Drew. At any rate, young man, thank you for taking us around the horn on infrastructure. We'll catch up with you next month.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.